Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, more than 355,000 people in the Hudson Valley are food insecure. Coming up, a conversation with the Regional Food Bank on how they met demand in 2025 and what challenges are ahead in the new year. State requirements, delayed bonding, and ambitious sales tax projections. There's more to Sullivan County's 2026 budget than meets the eye. We'll dig into the details with River Reporter news editor Liam Mayo. Looking back at some of our top stories of the past year, today, how an Indigenous-led nonprofit is challenging the Hudson Valley's artistic legacy. And it's a Super Bowl showdown in Eldred, S-O-U-P-E-R. Students are competing to collect canned goods for those in need. Learn more after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Commerce Department says the U.S. economy grew much faster than expected in the third quarter, at an annual rate of 4.3%. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports the figures are nearly 2 months behind schedule because of the government shutdown.
Between July and September, the report shows the U.S. economy growing at a robust pace, accelerating from the growth seen in the previous quarter. Earlier in the year, the economy had actually shrunk as companies rushed to ship foreign goods ahead of President Trump's global tariffs. Consumers remain the key engine, driving the growth with higher spending, especially on health care. The report calls out spending on hospital and nursing home services and on prescription drugs. People also spent more on, quote, information processing equipment. That could be computer hardware, presumably as part of the AI boom. At the same time, business and residential investment declined in the third quarter. Spending by state and local governments increased. Alina Selyuk, NPR News, Washington.
More than 1.6 million immigrants have lost their legal status since President Trump took office. This is the largest effort to make migrants deportable despite using legal pathways. NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran reports.
Immigration rights advocates say this figure, 1.6 million people, is likely an undercount, but it includes people who came to the U.S. via humanitarian parole, temporary protected status, and visas. Todd Schulte is the president of Forward.us, an immigration advocacy organization.
These were like legal pathways. People like did the thing the government asked them to do, and this government went and is kind of preemptively trying to revoke that status.
The Trump administration has said it has done more to limit legal and illegal immigration than any other administration. It has said it will continue its aggressive effort to crack down on immigration in 2026. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
Russian missile and drone strikes in multiple regions of Ukraine have killed at least three people. NPR's Hanna Palomarenko reports from Kyiv that Russians have again attacked Ukraine's energy facilities.
Ukraine's acting Minister of Energy, Artem Nekrasov, said that this is the ninth massive attack on Ukraine's energy sector this year. As a result of the attack, all Ukrainian nuclear power plants have reduced their electricity generation. This is a gross violation of international nuclear safety requirements, and it should not be ignored by the international community. Russia's policy of energy terrorism must be stopped, he said. As a result of the attack, several Western regions are almost completely without power. Emergency power outages continue throughout the country. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 31 points. This is NPR News in Washington. The Delaware Supreme Court is returning money to tech billionaire Elon Musk. A judge found a lower court had overstepped in rescinding a pay package that was once worth $55 billion and is now worth more than twice that. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
A Delaware court previously found that the Tesla board let Musk have too much influence over his own paycheck. The state Supreme Court didn't overturn that finding, but the justices said voiding Musk's entire pay package wasn't a fair remedy. Musk couldn't take back the years of work he did. Instead, they awarded a nominal $1 to the plaintiff who brought the case, plus attorney's fees. In response to the decision, Elon Musk posted on X, vindicated, and also, quote, I try not to start fights, but I do finish them. Forbes estimates that after the decision, Elon Musk's net worth is now a record $749 billion. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Federal regulators have approved a pill version of the popular weight loss drug Wegovy, which is currently only available as an injection. The pills could hit the market by early next year. Experts say the oral form may be more affordable and easier for patients to access. The drug's manufacturer, Novo Nordisk, has faced increased competition from rival drug makers, including Eli Lilly. The company says the pill form of Wegovy showed an average weight loss of nearly 17% during clinical trials. On Wall Street, the stocks are trading lower, the Dow down 11 points, the Nasdaq down 50. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Hunger remains a reality for hundreds of thousands of people across the Hudson Valley, even as food banks work to keep pace with rising costs and federal cuts. According to the regional food bank, more than 355,000 people in its 23-county service area are food insecure. In 2025, the food bank distributed roughly the same amount of food as the year before, despite losing hundreds of truckloads tied to federal funding cuts. Joining us now to look back on the past year and look ahead to 2026 is Barry Lewis of the Regional Food Bank. Barry, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Tim.
As we look back on 2025, how would you characterize the level of need compared with previous years? Are you seeing stabilization, growth, or new patterns of food insecurity?
Well, even before, when the year began, and really post-COVID, we saw in the region, and the Regional Food Bank has a 23-county area. We go up from the Canadian border down to and including Rockland County. It's nearly 40% of the landmass of New York State, so it's a large area. And we had seen that there was a increase in food insecurity. Just in the Hudson Valley alone, we were looking at about a 8% increase in this area, in the six-county region. For example, in Sullivan County, we were looking at one in five children being food insecure in this new year. And that was as the year began. And then, of course, we were hit with cuts to the SNAP program and a shutdown. And suddenly, in the last 3 months, we had folks who really had no economic means of getting more food. And the food bank had to step up, and through the generosity of a lot of donors and community partners, we were able to attempt to offset as best as we can a lot of those cuts.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those cuts. I mentioned in the introduction that you distributed roughly the same amount of food in 2025 as you did the year before, despite these significant federal disruptions. Talk about why that's such a notable accomplishment, because you lost more than, 200 truckloads of food because of USDA cuts, and that obviously had to impact your operations.
Yeah, as I said, in our 23-county service area, there are over 300,000 people with no safety net, and $59 million in monthly SNAP benefits were withheld in that area. That means the loss of about 36 million pounds of food per month. And really, no food bank would be able to offset that type of cut. Just the perspective, just to give listeners an idea, the Regional Food Bank would have needed to provide 36 million pounds of food monthly to meet the need filled by SNAP benefits. Well, we distribute 54 million pounds of food in all of 2024. So no charitable food system was designed to sustain the scope of services that SNAP provides. But I think what we saw was a real education. And, people really didn't have an idea of what SNAP benefits were about. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks, myself growing up, we knew of food stamps. but most people don't know what SNAP was. And really, SNAP program is, you know, a new idea of the old food stamp program. So I think people got an education, an idea, and they saw that through nothing on their end, they were hit with these cuts. So I think there was a lot of education. People began to realize, and they saw that their friends, their neighbors, their family members were experiencing this up and having to go to pantries for the first time in their lives. You know, we saw married couples both working, but finding that the cost of food and then the utility costs and healthcare costs all rising, and we're turning to food bank for some additional hand up, as we like to say.
Yeah,
and so I think what we saw was people getting an understanding, realizing the plight, and stepping up. And, you know, it was just tremendous to see the outpouring of support that we were getting this past year.
And you know, the visibility of how impactful that need is really did rally some folks. I'm going to talk about some of the other notable milestones in 2025, mainly that $25 million Montgomery facility that opened. Your CEO, Tom Nardacci, has said that opening allowed you guys to do more things you hadn't been able to do in decades. From your perspective, what changed most because of the expansion?
Well, what we were able to do is really we can now house, and it's hard to believe given this year that we opened in February, as you say, and it's a 50,000 square foot facility in Montgomery, and it's centrally located. So the USDA, ironically, their trucks were not able to go to our previous site in Cornwall on Hudson, and so so they would bring their trucks up to Latham, our site outside of Albany, and then our drivers and then our trucks would then have to come back down to the Hudson Valley, which meant that food was spending more time in the truck. It was spending less time in coolers. We didn't have the storage capacity. This new facility allows us to provide more fresh fruits, vegetables, shelf-stable meals. We can work with more farmers in the region. We can provide healthier food. We can store more, and we can give more to the community. For example, just yesterday alone, through the support of ShopRite, ShopRite gave us $95,000 in additional inventory, and we have this thing called Shop the Dock. So any of our community partners, when they're coming in to pick up food, there's also, on top of the food that they had ordered, we have coolers of fresh food that we want them to take, whatever they need, free. And that was something that we just could not do in our previous site. So this has been an education year, letting the partners know. We're still working out the details. In a six-county region, as you can imagine, there are parts of Ulster County that were still being serviced in the Latham area as opposed to the Orange County area, even though, you know, we certainly consider it more of the Hudson Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've been able to make more of a community impact. We're getting a lot more volunteers into our facility, and that's been a real great eye-opener. As more groups come in, they've seen the site. We've had groups that have come in just to use the facility for meetings, and that brings a great awareness to what we're doing as well.
I want to mention, of course, the volunteers. You rely on nearly 29,000 volunteers at the food bank, and you mentioned there are more volunteers because of the opening in Montgomery. Who have you noticed who's stepping up to volunteer, and what does that say about community response to hunger?
Sure. We always say, if it wasn't for the volunteers, we'd have to hire about more than two dozen full-time staff to offset the work that these volunteers do. And they come from all walks of life. We're finding a lot of businesses in the Hudson Valley encourage their workers to sign up, volunteer. People can go online to regionalfoodbank.net, and they can find out how they can volunteer. I think they get a real appreciation for what we're doing. And it's a great team building. We've seen groups come in, and they're all wearing the same T-shirts or sweatshirts. And from their CEOs to everybody, We're seeing banks, insurance companies, folks from Bethel Woods have come in, and the resorts world, and as I said, all the area banks, Jeff Bank and others have come in. The schools have come in. I think it's a great opportunity. You know, so many civic organizations will talk about having, you know, the need for next generations. But we see, besides the civic organizations, but we see a lot of schools encouraging senior classes to come in and work as a volunteer. And they're sorting and they're distributing, and they get an understanding of the need in the area. They see the food coming in. And as you said, 29,000 volunteers contributed more than 72,000 hours of service. We couldn't do it without that volunteer support.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Barry Lewis of the Regional Food Bank about meeting food insecurity in 2025, and now want to look ahead to 2026. Barry, what do you think some of the biggest challenges are, and what indicators are you watching most closely as you prepare for increased demand next year?
Right. Well, we certainly hope that we're not hit and with more SNAP cuts. And we are seeing on a very strong bipartisan basis that the government shutdown hurt the area, hurt people in need, and as did the SNAP cuts. And we've met with lawmakers on both sides, and they get it. They understand. They know that hunger does not look at political party, does not look at religion or skin color or age. Hunger has affected everyone. I think we're encouraged by the support that we've received. This past Thanksgiving, we did a historic, it was the largest thing, largest Thanksgiving food pickup and delivery event ever in New York State history, and where we were able to provide an unprecedented 115,000 Thanksgiving meals to 25,000 people in the Hudson Valley. We had over 1,000 community volunteers throughout our county Hudson Valley region help distribute. And our CEO, Tom Nadachi, has pledged that we're going to increase that in 2026. So I think what we're going to see is even more support going out to the pantries. And we're also trying to work with various groups. We have the backpack program. We provided nearly 2 million meals to 7,400 kids and teens through our backpack and school pantry programs. It's very frustrating. We see that, you know, we're in a state that is very generous with free lunch and breakfast programs, but you know, there's nothing to help these kids in need on the weekends. And so we work with a lot of schools. We work with Sullivan 180 on backpack programs. And I think we're going to look to expand that as well, working with the schools to make sure that more children do not go hungry on the weekends. We're working more with Garnet and the area hospitals as food as medicine programs. So, you know, I think we're expanding our nutrition program. So We realize that we have to do more than just service the pantries that we do and the churches, but find more creative ways to get food out to people in need.
Just a note that continuing resolution that helped end the government shutdown in 2025 runs out on January 30th, 2026, a little over a month from now. So hopefully lawmakers are going to come to some agreements before then and not have to force another shutdown impacting folks. Exactly.
And we're also realizing that people are going to start to feel the effects after the new year on their premiums and health insurance.
Right.
And we know, you know, in an area like Sullivan County where, you know, mass transportation can be difficult, that there are folks who are taking cab rides to get to the supermarket. And if they're spending $40, $50 on a round-trip cab ride, that's $40 or $50 that is not going to something else. And it's either going to be buying food, paying off a utility bill. medicine, and they're turning to the food banks because they really don't have alternatives. It's so disheartening, particularly this time of year, because we think of the holidays, and it really is about families coming together. And food is always so much central to, you know, the holiday feasts and people gathering. And it's some of our best traditions. It's what we remember as kids. And to hit some of these pop-up pantries, we've had to do more than 24 pop-up pantries in the last 6-7 weeks because, again, of the SNAP cuts. And we've just gone out to communities. We were in Highland Falls when the government shutdown happened because the folks who work at West Point were suddenly not getting a paycheck. And so, you know, they reached out to us. And I think we were working, and at that point we were working also on preparing for our Thanksgiving meal distribution. And the question was, well, can we provide more? And the answer, of course, was yes, we will. We'll figure out how, but we're going to do this. We're going to provide the food. And we reached out to our industry partners, and we said, can you give us more? There's got to be more available, and they all stepped up.
So finally, if someone listening wants to help, what makes the biggest difference right now?
You know, we always appreciate food being donated, but because we buy in such large bulk, what we can do, we always say that basically for every dollar, we can provide 4 meals. So certainly, I know a lot of folks look at this time of year, last couple of days of the season, and look to give to charities. They're very welcome to do so. We also are looking for folks to volunteer and help us out. So all that information is available. If they go to the regionalfoodbank.net, go onto the website, they can see how, get an understanding of all the different programs. And if they don't want to, can't make it to Montgomery, by looking at our website, they can see what pantries we service, and they're always able, and you know, they can help out their community pantries as well.
That's Barry Lewis of the Regional Food Bank. There's a link to the Regional Food Bank website and other food pantries in the region on our website as well at wjffradio.org. Barry, thank you, and happy holidays.
Hey, happy holiday to you and your listeners as well. Thank you very much.
Later, we'll hear from some Eldred students about their Super Bowl-themed food drive. It's S-O-U-P-E-R. But coming up next, Sullivan County lawmakers promised fiscal restraint, but some tough decisions may still be ahead. What does Sullivan County's 2026 budget really mean? Leah Mayo of the River Reporter joins us after the break. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. When George Frideric Handel wrote Messiah, he was past his prime and nearly broke.
He had 50 pounds left. He withdrew that, and he had nothing.
One night in Dublin changed that.
I love the idea that Handel, in his own life, is enacting the very logic that you find inside Messiah itself.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm Cassie from the Rare Pair Radio Show. I just want to wish you and yours a rockin' solstice. It's been a crazy year. Hope you and yours made it through okay. From all of us here at Radio Catskill, thanks for listening. Have a safe and festive holiday season. And a happy new year.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan County lawmakers have adopted the 2026 budget that includes a 2% property tax cut. But behind that headline number are several decisions raising questions about the county's long-term finances. Joining us now to break down the details is Liam Mayo, news editor of the River Reporter, who's been covering the budget process. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've been reporting on this budget, but you're reporting a little deeper here about how the lawmakers were emphasizing restraint and caution. And how did that set the tone for some of these decisions that followed? Because as some of our listeners may remember, it was a proposed 9% budget increase by the county manager, but then the legislature settled on just about 2%.
Yeah, so the original proposal that the public saw included a 9.1% increase to the county's property taxes. what legislators have said is that that number was kind of already a compromise down from an earlier version of the budget that was discussed, or that was like presented, or that came together in the county manager's office as the outcome of what the different departments were asking for. That version of the budget with that included everyone's requests would have meant a 15% property tax increase. That increase came down to 9.1% in the version of the budget that originally was sent around. And then that was brought down again to 2%, like a 2% tax increase in the final version of the budget that was adopted. There were a couple of things that were done to get it to that point. There were a few changes just to the expenses and revenues projected, such as decreasing contingency spending by around a little over $600,000, increasing anticipated expenses from EMS billing and electrical licensing. But a large chunk of that came from changing the anticipated revenues from sales tax, mm-hmm. Which I believe made up a little over $2 million of this budget. So the county revised upwards what it expects to get for sales tax from around $75 million to around $77.25 million. And that's where legislators kind of argued back and forth about that, with some legislators thinking that that is a number potentially in line with previous projections, other legislators saying that this is kind of like shoddy lawmaking and this is like fudging the numbers to get the budget to a place where it could include just a 2% property tax increase.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about that sales tax assumption, but also want to point out some of the other things that are tied in with all of this. One of the biggest unresolved issues tied to the budget is the courthouse expansion. Can you explain why Sullivan County is being pushed toward expanding the courthouse and then what that means in terms of the budget that was passed?
Yeah, this is something that was discussed as a separate issue. Sullivan County, according to the legislature, needs to expand its, or is being required by the state to expand its courthouse to include more courtroom space for the judges, as well as to move circuit and family courts there. And it's waiting for details from the New York State Office of Court Administration for the requirements of that space. But this is where kind of the budget has gotten legislators looking very, very closely at every potential expenditure. The legislator was voting that day on a $3 million bond resolution to start like work on the design for that building. Legislators didn't say, to be clear, they didn't say they weren't going to spend that money. They just said like, okay, given that, the budget is kind of coming in so tight this year, let's wait until we really have to, until we get more details about this project to authorize bonding for this money. And there were a couple of other things like that that came out throughout the meeting. There was a significant discussion on bonding for a field house or for the county's share of field house work at Sullivan County Community College. I believe that was one that was pushed off, sort of similar to the courthouse one. There was significant discussion around bonding for roadwork and bridges. That one did pass. But again, this is all stuff that like would, I think, in other circumstances pass very, very quickly. Whereas this time, legislators had a lot of discussion about it just because they're going to be looking very closely at every line item in every expense report from here on out. And several legislators said as much throughout the meeting, too, that they would be from Cat Scott being one of them, who said, District 5 legislator, who said that whether or not something is budgeted for is going to be a deciding factor on whether it gets passed in the year ahead. So the county has passed its budget, but the ramifications of that are going to continue into the new year as, different positions get proposed or projects get proposed or other things get brought up. It's sounding like the legislature is going to keep a much more careful eye on what it's spending than it might in a year where this budget didn't go down this way.
Yeah, and then those sales tax assumptions, the budget relies heavily on optimistic sales tax projections to achieve this 2% tax cut. But if those sales tax numbers don't materialize and the county has to dip into reserves, what does that do for the rest of the things that they might be trying to plan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just, it's all going to be up in the air at this point. Exactly what's going to happen depending on where those sales tax numbers came in. And legislators were sort of more or less hopeful that they were, depending on which legislator it was speaking. Outgoing County Treasurer Nancy Buck told the legislature that she stood by her original figures and didn't agree with what the county was doing today with that budget. So that was sort of the and expert opinion on it. But I think, you know, it's the sales tax, like where those figures come in, is also kind of largely going to depend on, you know, how the economy is doing, how, you know, federal things are doing. Like it's there's so much tied into it that, you know, if the county's betting on better than average expectations of sales tax revenue or better expectations of sales tax revenue than they might otherwise would have been, they could be facing a shortfall there at the same time that like a lot of other things are hitting the county financially, say from the general economy or other such things. So I think it's just going to be something we have to follow over the course of the next year to see how it turns out and to see whether the county will need to take any corrective action to work around different holes in its budget.
Even as legislators focused on cutting or containing spending, they approved a salary increase for the sheriff, a $145,000 salary higher than originally proposed. What was the rationale for giving that increase?
Yeah, so this was something that, if I was reading numbers correctly, both the sheriff and the treasurer were set to like have increased salaries in the next year. And this is just a regular thing that happens when they get reelected, as far as I understand it. Both the sheriff and the treasurer were set to get $135,000. However, in that legislature meeting, that was amended upwards for the sheriff to $145,000. And legislators who supported this basically said that like they wanted to acknowledge the importance of the work the sheriff does in providing law enforcement for the county and the importance of that role to the county. The legislators who voted against it said that they had nothing against the person in that position, but they, you know, valued having that parity between elected officials. So the parity in pay between the sheriff and the treasurer, rather than having what ended up happening, which is one of those offices valued above the other.
And just in talking to you, talking to Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government about this and just following this process along, this really does seem like a short-term compromise that's pushing some of these difficult decisions into the future versus something that's sustainable.
Yeah. I forget which legislator off the top of my head said this, but one of the legislators said that this was kind of a holding pattern budget, or that this was a budget that, like, you know, could do what it needed to do, but it didn't really push the county forward, which that 9.1% tax increase would have pushed the county forward. So it'll be interesting to see sort of next year when it comes time to talk about the budget again, whether the county is in a position to go for a more ambitious budget or to include sort of more ambitious things in it. I think, you know, how we got to where we are is a lot of people coming to the legislature and saying that they just really can't handle a 9.1% property tax increase right now, or that is an excessive property tax increase for right now. And the legislators who voted for this, like even the legislators who voted for this, seemed to think it wasn't exactly the best thing for the county as a whole, but they were public servants and they had heard very clearly from the public that this is what the public wanted, is a budget that came in under the tax cap at that 2% property tax increase mark. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the county is capable of doing with this budget over the past year or over the next year, what it's able to move forward, what it might have to compromise on,
and you know, how the financial situation is looking next year when the county comes time to make this decision all over again.
Yeah. Well, we know you'll be keeping an eye on it. We'll be keeping an eye on it with you. That's Liam Mayo, news editor of The River Reporter. You can read about his deep dive into the Sullivan County budget at riverreporter.com, as well as all of the other reporting from the team there. Liam, thank you for joining us, and happy holidays.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays yourself.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, looking back at one of our top stories of the year, how an Indigenous-led nonprofit is challenging the Hudson Valley's artistic legacy. That's coming up next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey there, it's Jason Dole here, checking in. Hope you're having a good holiday season so far. And as we count down to the end of the year at Radio Catskill, we're also counting up to our year-end goal, and we're counting on you to help make it happen. Please make your donation now at WJFFradio.org and triple your support. That's thanks to generous matching donations from Newsmatch and an anonymous longtime Radio Catskill supporter. Plus, gifts of $100 or more will also be entered for a chance to win a two-night stay at the Artist's Cottage Bed and Breakfast. It's a renovated farmhouse in Walton, New York. So make a one-time donation or become a sound supporter by the end of the year. Let these good folks triple your gift and help Radio Catskill stay strong in the new year. The first full year, by the way, that we won't be receiving any funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Please, do your part. Go to WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org and give today. Thank you so much.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Hudson Valley is no stranger to the arts. Think of Thomas Cole's monumental paintings that came out of the Hudson River School of the mid-19th century. Those romantic depictions of the serene river lined with pine trees or cascading shots of the Catskill Mountains the region is famous for. But what these historical paintings noticeably lack are its original inhabitants. In July, Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke with The Forge Project, an Indigenous-led nonprofit that's been working to interrogate that artistic history.
One of the things that kind of particular movement, we can say, in landscape painting, which is, you know, the distinct history of the Hudson River painters here, but also this is told many other places, is that this is their cultural practice of imagining a world that is present for their exploitation. And so those images, to me, are more of a case study on settler colonialism than they are a representation of Indigenous worlds, because this is what they imagine.
The Hudson Valley is no stranger to the arts. Think of Thomas Cole's monumental paintings that came out of the Hudson River School of the mid-19th century, his romantic depictions of the serene river lined with pine trees, or cascading shots of the Catskills Mountains the region is famous for. But what these historical paintings of the natural landscape here noticeably lack are people, specifically its original inhabitants. Forge Project, an Indigenous-led nonprofit located on the unceded land of the Moikana community in Columbia County, has been working to interrogate that artistic legacy. Established in 2021, the organization aims to elevate contemporary Indigenous artists and cultural practitioners and expand their leadership within these domains. It is led by an Indigenous steering council composed of 7 Indigenous leaders and has a working relationship with the nearby Stockbridge-Munsee community in Wisconsin, where many members are descended from the Mohican who inhabited upstate New York before they were forcibly displaced by settlers. Sarah Piscardilli is Forge's Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality and Indigenous multidisciplinary artists themselves. After introducing themselves in their native Northern Chumash language to start their interview with Radio Catskill, Dilly said the nonprofit's focused on supporting contemporary Indigenous artists and cultivating relationships between them through their on-site programming is about directly challenging the legacies of settler colonialism. This includes not only the removal of Indigenous tribes from the Hudson Valley region, but also the, quote, past tensing of Indigenous communities as no longer existent in the face of this country's continuous attempts at cultural assimilation and physical elimination.
Hachu Hachu Mita Sara Biscara Dili, Wamitana and Kitanas Muntil Hinkatichu, Kishu Tichu Kaatakashla Ni Sithala, Wa Samimu, Wa Sitakawayu, Wa Tisimasu, Wa Etsmal, Wa Sitakaka, Wa Sitakaya, Wa Elawehe, Wa Asaram, Wa Casas Grandes, Wa Zinapekuro, Wa Santa Catarina, Wasikpats, Wasil Koshoyo, Wa Waimeya, Wa Setakawa. Chiakyam Nipu needs pu teach you sa itaramansi, Mitakana misakana wa miikinahua na needs pu til hinkatichu, wa yakishtono, wa yakitanasmu, wa yakisisime, wa University of California, Davis, ni Native American Studies, wa Forge Project, ni Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality. Saying hello, my name is Sarah Biscardilli. I'm letting you know that I come from good people, from villages, primarily throughout Yaktichu Tichu, Yaktiltini homelands, which are in the central coast of California. We're about halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles on the coast. I also have genealogical connection to villages in southern Sweden, some in central Mexico, and one on the Big Island of Hawaii. I live in Munsee-speaking people's homelands. And I'm letting you know that my knowledge comes from my language, my family, our homelands. I have a PhD in Native American Studies from UC Davis, and I currently serve as the Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality here at Forge.
I'm wondering if you could go into, you know, where does the Forge Project kind of fit into challenging that historical legacy within the Hudson Valley, within the Catskills, of really bringing Indigenous artists and their visions of themselves and their land?
You know, I would say quite simply, it's through affirming our existence. It's choosing to center our narratives and the like inherent diversity of the worlds that we're speaking from. We have a growing collection of contemporary Native art. We have around 180 pieces in the collection right now. That is part of a lending collection. So those, you know, we get to enjoy works that are like at rest or they're not in a show, but at any point in time, I believe it's 30 to 60 works are on view in exhibitions nationally and internationally. But while, you know, we get to enjoy the pieces here. So some of that is just really presence. We do a lot of work to really support Indigenous cultural practitioners. Our fellowship serves not just artists, but cultural practitioners of all kinds. We have a fellowship. There are 6 spots every year. Of those 6 spots, 2 are guaranteed to Stockbridge Munsee community members or descendants, first and second line descendants, in recognition of our responsibility to homeland communities. Resident or fellows are welcome to come spend up to 3 weeks in residence on the campus here, but it's not a requirement of the fellowship. Each fellow is given an unrestricted cash award of $25,000 in recognition of their practice. So it's really about just recognizing the work that is already happening within Native communities. And one of the parts of the position that I steward that I really love is also facilitating convenings for Indigenous people. We have a convening coming up in the fall that is called Confluence. It's an Indigenous art criticism residency. So it's also trying to not only support artists and cultural practitioners, but also to support the deepening and expansion of like critical responses to it. We want more Indigenous people writing about Indigenous art. I also want more Indigenous people writing back to those kind of art historical histories or this context that we were talking about earlier.
Candace Hopkins, Forge's executive director and chief curator, as well as a citizen of the Carcross Tagish First Nation in Canada, said they've been able to support more than 300 Indigenous cultural workers as a result of these different programs. Specifically, their lending collection of 180 works has expanded to be one of the leading collections of its kind in the United States. When you enter Forge's main residence, you'll likely encounter some of these works on display, such as a large-scale photograph of Tlingit Unanga artist Nicholas Glannon's installation Never Forget, wherein 45-foot letters spelling the words Indian Land were mounted outside of Palm Springs in reference to the Hollywood sign back in 2021.
I feel like what we can do as an organization ultimately is to change the narrative. So one example is our lending collection of contemporary Native art. We use that not only to build knowledge about the incredible artists who've been making this work since time immemorial, essentially, but we use it to put pressure on, right? Like we ask questions like, why was the last group exhibition of Native art at the Museum of Modern Art, you know, why did that take place in 1942? Why hasn't there been one since? Why was the only solo exhibition in 2020? You know, why have these major collections of contemporary American art, you know, really ignored the work of Native artists? That's both, I think, passive and really conscious marginalization of Native artists.
This comes as the art world has increasingly faced criticism in the last few decades for its stealing of indigenous cultural objects to fill the inventories of museums like the American Museum of Natural History. Although the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, otherwise known as NAGPRA, was passed in 1990 to address the right of indigenous communities to have museums and federal agencies return stolen human remains and sacred objects, the process of repatriation has often been a painful one, Dilley, who had served on the University of California's NAGPRA Oversight and Implementation Committee, said. Furthermore, they explain that the institutional exclusion of indigenous voices has contributed to not only this issue, but also the whitewashing of indigenous artistic traditions.
Your website said something really interesting that I wanted to ask if you could kind of expand upon, and that is, quote, "We recognize indigenous art as the foundation of all contemporary art, not simply as a facet of our history or historical context."
You know, I think it's something that has always rubbed me the wrong way, that there needs to be this specific delineation as, oh, there's the history of American art that starts at the moment of settlement. It starts with European introduction, rather than looking at the fact that there has been long, complex, layered, influential material art histories that begin in this place and existed long before the conceptualization of America. I think part of what maybe planted the seed for that, like, I'm going to talk about this dissonance, is that I was really privileged to have started my undergrad at the Institute of American Indian Arts, which is the only tribal art school in the United States. But I really credit IA with offering this kind of foundation where our art historical canon is taught at the center. It gave me that fire that I needed to be able to write from that place of directness, where I'm like, I don't have any question about whether or not our contributions and the ways that our practices have been absolutely influential to capital A art. You know, indigenous people invented abstraction, and I'm talking about globally. There are so many movements in art history that are directly connected to the contributions of indigenous people all over the world, and like those contributions have been erased.
But in their desire to disrupt rather than reproduce the harm institutions have enacted against indigenous communities, Forge has had to critically look inwards as well. The nonprofit recently shifted from being a private organization to a nonprofit led by the Indigenous Steering Council, which is intentionally modeled after traditional forms of collective governance in indigenous communities. In addition, they have also established a memorandum of understanding with the Stockbridge Munsee community, whose ancestral lands they occupy.
I was really privileged to work alongside Monique Tyndall, who's the Director of Cultural Affairs at Stockbridge Munsee Community, and we just started by having conversations. I think the first email I sent to her, I just asked, you know, what are your ongoing initiatives and like how can we lighten your load? Instead of coming to them with a preconceived idea of how we were going to work together, which is often what organizations are doing. So we spent the better part of a year co-writing a memorandum of understanding, and that was done really with that diplomatic intent. It was also done collaboratively so we could map out commitments and deliverables that actually made the most sense for the community. There was a lot of kind of alignment with the Cultural Affairs Department, which is why that's where the relationship lives. But when we had the completed MOU, it was looked over by, you know, the tribe's lawyers, and it was voted in by their tribal council. So we're really trying to recognize the sovereignty of their government through how we're working with them. So we mapped out 3 years of deliverables. This year we've been like getting to do the fun part of it, which is like actually implementing some of the programs. And that's been really wonderful to get to do collaboratively. But it's also an MOU that requires like re-engagement and renewal every 3 years so that the deliverables stay aligned with the most emergent needs of the community. But then there's also that, again, building in that responsibility of relation into how we're doing things.
Hopkins said this also means that they do not take the land they are located on lightly. In addition to the work they do within the art realm, the nonprofit is also engaged in land remediation and research efforts. They've reintroduced native species in the meadow that sits below the hilltop with their two residences, as well as developed a cultural easement agreement with the Stockbridge Munsee community that encourages their cultural access to and stewardship of the land. And you've kind of already touched on it, but I was wondering if you could go more into, you know, why it's important that the actual land the Forge Project is located on serves as a major pillar of the work you guys do.
The health of the land will be our legacy. You know, buildings have temporary lifespans. If we think of things in the age of like land or geologic age, right? We are into extraordinary buildings that were designed by the artist and activist Ai Weiwei. But one of the first things we did was, you know, the land we're situated on, which is Mohican land, traditionally, historically, it was all mown and tended lawn. Lawn, the particular kind of lawn grass, you know, we learned this through botanists that we collaborate with, Claudia Nab Vispo from Hawthorne Valley Farmscape Ecology, is actually originally from Northern Africa. You know, the Hudson Valley now is a place of a lot of introduced species of plants. But I also think that there's, you know, it's also witness to a kind of world out of balance. That's why we have such a bad tick epidemic. You know, climate change shifts our ecosystems quite radically. So one of the first things that we did was engage with Misty Cook, who's a plant knowledge holder from Stockbridge Munsee community. She did a plant analysis for us. Then we started engaging with Claudia and, you know, other really deep allies and knowledge holders. And we worked with them to welcome back native seeds to the land. And the land now is part of a memorandum of understanding between us as Forge Project and Stockbridge Munsee community that's been ratified by their tribal council, is officially tribal, or is officially cultural easement for the tribe. That's not land back. However, I think it's a good model that other organizations should start embarking on if they are on land of cultural significance.
Culture and all it encompasses, Hopkins argues, is what builds our society, a site of potential that Forge has taken advantage of to disrupt settler colonialism and envision a new world.
My belief is that culture is a signifier of the health of any society. And culture broadly means not just visual art, doesn't just mean song, doesn't mean music. It means all of those things together. It means dance. It means, you know, storytelling. It means theater. It means all of those things. It means the ability to have, you know, work in your own languages and indigenous languages, for example. All of those contribute to a healthy society. And so much of the history of settler colonialism has been about not only legally and violently removing those things from our cultures as Native people through boarding schools, for example, through displacement, through both direct and attempted genocide, not just cultural genocide, through removal. That's why we believe, you know, we focus on cultural leaders broadly, so not just the visual arts, but also artists, because they're all part of this investment in creating healthier futures.
I just spoke with Sarah Pascara-Dilley and Candace Hopkins of the Forge Project on the nonprofit and how it's expanding Indigenous leadership within the art world. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
And there's more information at forgeproject.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, who will win the Super Bowl, S-O-U-P-E-R, that bowl? Eldred students are turning canned goods into school pride and helping neighbors in need. We'll hear from them next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Since 1770, musicians of historic Trinity Church have inspired concertgoers with their interpretation of Handel's oratorio Messiah. It wouldn't be Christmas time without it. Hear this holiday favorite sung by the choir of Trinity Church and played on period instruments under the direction of Andrew McGill. Handel's Messiah from Trinity Church.
Christmas Day at midnight on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This winter, students in the Eldred Central School District are turning school spirit into community service. Eldred Junior Senior High School and George Ross McKenzie Elementary are facing off in a friendly Super Bowl competition. That's spelled S-O-U-P-E-R. Collecting canned goods for local families in need. The drive runs through February 5th with donations collected at concerts and sporting events across the district. I spoke with two of the student organizers behind the effort, Tabitha Smith, and Marissa Gauchenauer.
So Eldred's always done like some sort of food drive. Like we just finished one for Thanksgiving and we decided we need something else to give back for like the winter months. So that's how we came across the Super Bowl.
And why did your schools choose to make it like a friendly competition between Eldred, JHSH, and GRM Elementary?
It gives more of like an incentive to kids and their families and like their community to give back because they have like, they feel the pride of winning, like the competition.
And Marissa, why do you think it's important for students to give back and participate in community service like this?
I feel like our community does a lot for us. So it's really important that we give back to them.
What do you hope to achieve by the end of the drive? Tell folks the goal here.
We really just want to help, like, solve anyone's, like, hunger or issues that they have. Like, we really just want to help anyone that needs it.
And how long will the drive run? And where can people drop off donations?
We're collecting donations at school and at any school events, like concerts, sports events, anything like that. And we are collecting until February 5th.
Have people been donating already? And have you been getting a good response?
Yeah, we actually just had a basketball game last night. And I think we had about like 30 cans donated already.
That's great. So in addition to the food that you collect, what else is it that you hope to achieve by the end of the drive?
Hopefully, like, people want to get more involved with community service by, like, knowing how much they're helping people with this, that they'll want to start helping people with other things.
I understand you guys brought this idea to the larger county level. Talk a little bit about that.
We're just trying to like inspire the other schools to get involved with this food drive. So hopefully we do live in a small town, so getting it on a larger scale would be good.
So who did you bring this idea to try to get it to a larger scale?
The president of our countywide student council. I believe he's from Sullivan West.
And are they interested in adopting this idea and participating as well?
Yeah, they seemed like they were.
All right. Well, you guys are really starting a movement here. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Just before we go, what motivated you personally to get involved with this food drive, Tabitha?
So I've participated in different like community service events prior to this, and I feel like some sort of like joy that comes out of it. For giving back, so.
And Marissa, what about you?
Yeah, pretty much same thing for me.
Okay. That's Tabitha Smith and Marissa Gauchenauer, the students who helped lead the Super Bowl food drive in Eldred. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
And every little bit helps neighbors helping neighbors. There is, again, a list of local food pantries and food resources available at our website if you want to help out some folks together. We can all make a difference. Just go to wjffradio.org. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Jason Dole letting you know how you can help nourish our neighbors. More families are struggling to put food on the table. Local food pantries are stepping up, but they need help. You can donate non-perishable food, personal care items, or baby supplies, or volunteer to assist with distribution. It can make a real difference. Learn more at WJFFradio.org to help make sure everyone in our community has enough to eat. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Checking the weather, that winter storm advisory is still in effect, but now a winter storm warning in effect until 4 o'clock this afternoon, specifically for Sullivan County and Northeast Pennsylvania. Heavy snow, additional snow accumulations of 2 to 4 inches expected this afternoon, bringing storm totals across the region from 5 to 10 inches. The roads are slippery. The heaviest snow continues through the morning hours. It will quickly taper off into a drizzle around 1, according to the National Weather Service. Some higher elevation freezing drizzle is possible this afternoon. If you have to go out, please be careful. The latest road conditions for the state you're calling from can be obtained by calling 511. Tonight, cloudy, windy, 30 for a low. Tomorrow, very windy, high 36. And for Christmas Day, a high of 40 with some breeziness continuing. Again, a winter storm warning in effect until 4 for Sullivan County and Northeast Pennsylvania. Specifically, a winter weather advisory remains in effect for the region until 4 o'clock. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville, broadcasting from our studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Catskill.